Welcome to the Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Dave Buhner. I am filling in for Kevin Swanson today as Kevin is taking a much-deserved rest and vacation, a little time away from the microphone and the telephone and the computer and spending a good amount of time with his wife and his children. Well, I'm just a father of five here in the Front Range of Colorado trying to figure out how to preserve a little bit of faith and family and freedom in this coming age. You know, I really care about the world that I'm going to leave my children, and I think that world is under a great threat right now. One of the greatest threats facing them is Copenhagen. Right now in Copenhagen, of course, the World Summit on Climate Change is taking place, where every ruler, thug, and dictator is gathering to talk about the weather. They're going to talk about trying to control the weather, as if man possibly could control the weather. They're going to talk about change of the weather. Yeah, the weather's changing. Of course the weather's changing. That's why you turn on the news and you watch the weatherman. If it was the same every day, you wouldn't need a weatherman. It would just be the same. You don't have a gravity man. You don't turn on the news and say, well, what's the gravity going to be like tomorrow? Well, the gravity stays the same, but the weather is constantly changing. And so is the climate. You know, it changes from one day to the next, and it changes from one season to the next, and there are annual variations. But they're going to get together in Copenhagen, and they're going to talk about climate change because somebody has a silly notion that man is making the weather change. But whatever it is, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, the sky is falling, and that's what's important, is the sky is falling, and we must do something about it. It was sort of humorous. Al Gore, responding to Sarah Palin the other day, said that weather change is a fact, like gravity. Except that man doesn't influence gravity, and man can't do anything about gravity. And I think in that regard, perhaps, he has a point that climate change and gravity are very similar. Well, in Copenhagen, it's not going well there. First off, the science is absolutely falling apart. If there was science there to begin with, the perception that there was science is falling apart. As you probably have heard, there were some emails that were leaked out from one of these very important scientific labs that were talking about the climate change and much research, and many of the conclusions were based on the work of these labs. And the emails leaked out showed that the data that the labs were working on was cooked. They cooked the books. They subtracted some degrees from older temperatures, and they added to some more modern, more contemporary temperatures to try and show an upward trend so that they could show that it's getting warmer or the sky is falling. Yes, they manipulated the data. You're not allowed to do that in science, by the way, but they did. What's worse is the data is no longer available. The raw data has not been preserved so that some scientists could go back and observe the same data and verify the data, which is, of course, what science is predicated on. Science, by the way, came from a Christian worldview. Francis Bacon, who's generally considered the father of the scientific method, understood that because God is unchangeable, in his character, he created a world, and we can predict the future based on the past. Therefore, we can use an inductive method. That is, we can make a lot of observations, and from those observations, we can formulate a principle that models those observations. That's the modern scientific method. But it requires verifiable and observable data. Unfortunately, these global warming scientists, quote unquote, don't have verifiable data. In the instances where some people have dug far enough into the raw data to get that kind of information, the information of the raw data, what these predictions are made, we end up with assertions that there is going to be a hockey stick graph that models the Earth's temperature. That is, there's going to be a rapid increase. But that supposition is based on historic data of three trees in Russia. just 3 trees. That, my friends, is a statistical sample that is nonsense. So, you see, the science is falling apart. In fact, this very week, the United Nations has issued the report that natural disasters are at a decade low. Yeah, those disasters that are caused by floods and hurricanes, they're at a decade low. Now, I know that the global climate change crowd will say that proves the point. See, if we have a disaster, that's because of global climate change. And if we don't have a disaster, that's because of global climate change, too. If it's getting warmer, that's global climate change. If it's getting colder, that's global climate change. Whatever it is, the sky is falling, and that's what's important, because it's not the science that matters here. All you have to do is look at what's happening at Copenhagen this week. There is a developing boycott, and some countries are walking out of these meetings, not because of the science. See, the science never mattered. But because of the politics, what is really going on here is a redistribution of the wealth. The scheme that they're talking about in Copenhagen is having the countries that produce, the industrialized countries, paying a ransom to the non-producing countries who don't produce carbon dioxide in order to keep them from developing and producing carbon dioxide. So the developing countries are going to pay the non-developing countries to not develop. In other words, we want to see disease, and we want to see sickness, and we want to see poverty exist in these third world nations in perpetuity, and we'll pay them for it. Now, the third world countries, if they're going to go along with this, they understand they have to strike while the iron's hot. See, they're going to shake down the industrialized countries for more money. This is the way it works with men. You see, if you pay somebody not to work, you think you're giving them too much because they're not producing anything and you're paying them. That's kind of insanity. That's not a good fiscal policy. Well, the person who's getting paid not for working, though, tends to want a raise. If you're going to pay him $5 not to work, he can not work twice as much for $10, right? And this is what's happening. Third world countries are holding out for more money or more wealth. Now, I don't even know if it's money, because we've invented this fake currency of carbon credits. It's a fake gold. You can't hold it. You can't see it. It doesn't do you any good. But we're going to make this fake currency, and Al Gore's company is going to produce or sell or trade. I guess you don't produce carbon credits because they aren't really anything, but they're going to trade these carbon credits. So Al Gore, who is making millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, some have estimated, from this global warming, this global climate change crisis. Well, Al Gore's not had a very good week in Copenhagen. I think he's having an Excedrin week. He said that in 7 years, there's a 75% chance there would be no ice in the Arctic. All the ice would be gone, you know, except for a few Eskimos drinking their pina coladas who would have to make it in the freezer. But the ice caps would be totally gone, or at least there's a 75% chance of that. Well, the problem was that Al Gore said that that prediction was based on the work of a certain scientist, Dr. Maslowski. Now, the problem is that Maslowski is still alive, and Maslowski said, nope, not my prediction, and I don't know how my data would support that prediction. Thank you, Al Gore, don't use my name anymore. So Al Gore has been a little bit embarrassed, even though he stands to make a lot of money. You'd think he would be embarrassed because this climate summit reflects his own life. That is, they talk about the dangers, the horrors of producing carbon dioxide, all the while the profits of carbon dioxide are producing more than anyone else. The amount of carbon dioxide produced by this global warming summit, planes coming in and the limousines driving around and the air conditioning in the hotels and the heating that's being used, some have estimated it to exceed the production of carbon dioxide by most third world nations for the year. See, they're getting together to talk about how bad it is while producing more. Now, Gore's, you may know, has a very inefficient home with a heating, swimming pool, and flies a private jet. So he flies around the world telling everybody how bad private jets are and how bad heating, swimming pools are. And you'd think they'd be embarrassed about that, but they're really not. I guess for $100 million, you might want to be embarrassed, too, from time to time. Well, one of the most nefarious parts of this global climate summit is that many of these thugs, dictators, and tyrants believe that the problem is your children. many of them have publicly stated, it's on the record, it's part of the negotiations at Copenhagen, it is the opinion of the science czar of this White House that there are too many children on the planet, and their desire is to implement a one-child-only policy. Because they do not believe that children are a blessing from the Lord. Because they breathe. And when they breathe, they exhale. And when they exhale, they produce carbon dioxide. I'm just crazy enough to believe that God, in his wisdom, created plants and animals. Both living things. And as the animals breathe in oxygen, and like humans, we exhale carbon dioxide. But the plants inhale the carbon dioxide, and they release the oxygen. See, God's awfully wise. And it's the hubris of men to think that our production of carbon dioxide could change the weather. The amount of carbon dioxide all of industrial man has produced in the whole history of industrial man is but a tiny fraction of the amount of carbon dioxide a good volcano eruption will produce. We are foolish people because we no longer worship the Creator. We hug trees and we worship the earth on Earth Day. And though professing to be wise, we have become fools. Well, we're going to take a break right now. We're going to come back. We're going to talk trash when we get back on Generations. Stay put.
Folks, we are in the middle of the greatest recession since World War II. Unemployment continues to rise after 22 months of recession. Will the national bailouts and the massive redistribution of the wealth into irresponsible banks really help the situation? Will John Maynard Keynes' fractional reserve indebted system work out in the long run? I mean, he didn't think it was going to work in the long run. If you're a Christian father and mother, and you care about the future of your children and grandchildren, I'm telling you, it's time to work on Plan B. That's why we're doing a Family Economics Conference coming up here on March 5th and 6th, 2010. This will be a hands-on, practical conference bringing biblical perspectives to bear in every area of family economics. We're talking work. We're talking family entrepreneurism, debt-free living, contractual employment, inheritance, being a faithful employee, taking care of aging parents, living without Social Security, which, by the way, will happen, saving and investments, retirement, family charity, education, mentorship, taxation, health care decisions, seeking employment, raising dominion-minded daughters. We have found the best speakers in America who have studied and written on biblical family economics. It's time to work on Plan B, my friends. If you have a family and you are living in the American economy today, you need to check out this Family Economics Conference on March 5th and 6th, 2010. Check it out at kevinswanson.com. That's kevinswanson.com. Check it out now.
Back on the Generations Radio broadcast, my name is Dave Buhner, filling in for Kevin Swanson. We've been talking about the threats to our children, especially the threat at Copenhagen, those who would love the planet Earth, those greenies who love the planet and want to preserve it for our children. They just don't want you to have children, and they want your children to be able to produce anything. They certainly don't want any dominion taking going on. But it's, trust me, it's for the children. Just ask them. Well, we want to talk a little bit about trash today. Trash is one of those things that you produce when you produce. If you consume something, you end up with products and byproducts that aren't part of the goal of the production, and those are generally considered trash or waste or refuse. So let's say you're manufacturing wooden furniture. You end up producing sawdust probably in that production, and that sawdust is a byproduct or a waste product. Now, we have various strategies to deal with those waste products. When it's profitable to use those waste products in a second process, most industries will do that. Let's take the furniture industry, for example. They take the waste product from the wood that they're using, and they have other processes, such as making particle board, that they use with even the sawdust and the wood chips. At the very least, they would take the little ends, the scraps, the pieces of wood in a small shop, and they would burn them in the corner to produce heat to keep the shop warm. Using another process where they're using the scrap for heat, and yet that's going to produce some smoke and some ash. And that ash then might be used in a garden to help grow new trees that can be made into furniture later on. Well, I want to go back to 1980s. There was a bureaucrat whose name was J. Winston Porter, and J. Winston Porter wrote a study for the Environmental Protection Agency, where and he became sort of a star, because Porter proclaimed that we are running out of landfill space. We had a trash crisis. Now, what he noted was that the number of landfills in the United States was dropping, so we had fewer landfills. But what Mr. Porter, in his zeal, failed to mention, or perhaps failed to notice, was that though the number of landfills were dropping, the capacity was growing. In fact, the capacity is continuing to rise. Why were the numbers falling? Well, it's a pretty simple explanation. Most people don't want a landfill in their backyard. It's the not in my backyard syndrome. So there are fewer and fewer places you could locate a landfill, but when you found one, you want to make it count and you put a big one. If you put all the trash together in one place, it might make a pretty good pile. But if you put all the trash in the United States together in one pile, how big would it be? Well, if you were to take it for the next 100 years, if you were to have one landfill that would hold our trash for the next 100 years, for the whole United States, it's not that big of a space. Washington, D.C. could hold all the trash for the next 100 years, and we'd only have to go about halfway up the Washington Monument. Sort of, it'd be like a little thermometer to tell us how high our trash is there. About halfway up is about all we would need for the next 100 years. Now, that's a lot of trash, no doubt. But that trash decomposes, for the most part, and is a recycling process. Let's think about it. You take some paper that comes from a tree that took nutrients out of the ground and the carbon dioxide that everyone's so worried about, and it turns it into a product that can be manufactured into paper. We take that paper, we write on it, we hand in our homework, we get a little red ink on it, we throw it in the trash, and it goes to the landfill where it decomposes, where it turns into the dirt and nutrients, where yet another tree can grow. So when we do our waste management, we are, in fact, recycling of a kind. Our recycling systems, our landfill systems, are more efficient now than they have ever been. Waste Management plans to turn 60 of their waste sites, this is a company, a private company, into energy facilities. By the year 2012, these dumps, if you want to call them that, will be capturing methane gas from the decomposing landfills, estimated to generate more than 700 megawatts of electricity. That's enough electricity to provide the power for 700,000 homes for the year. That's a lot of power from our trash. New modern landfills are state-of-the-art. They're lined with redundant clay and plastic liners. The systems that they're used now are not only more efficient at decomposing, but they leave something solid behind. In Colorado Springs, we have a brand new hospital, beautiful hospital, way up on the hill. You can see it from everywhere in town, built on a landfill. The same people are complaining about we're running out of space in landfills, which, by the way, we're not. We have more space than we've ever had. Are the same people that say what we need to do instead of filling our landfills is recycle. In fact, San Francisco has given new meaning to the word boondoggle. They have created a mandatory recycling ordinance. And all residences, all restaurants, all commercial buildings must, this is mandatory participation in the city's recycling and composting programs. They did a recent study and they found that 36% of the landfill waste is compostable. They can compost it. So this is the very ingredient that turns into the rich dirt, and it's the very ingredients that are going to produce the energy. So they've decided that they need to separate that out in order to save the planet. So now in San Francisco, residents will face a $100 fine if they fail to separate their food scraps from their papers and cans. So if you throw out a little lettuce, it's got to go in the food scrap bag, but your cans and your plastic jugs have to go in a different bag, and your glass has to go in a different bag. And if you don't, you can face a $100 fine the first time. If you're a business, it's a $500 fine. And if you have a repeated offense, it could be up to a $1,000 fine. The stated goal of the program in San Francisco is to have zero waste, meaning no garbage going into the landfills by the year 2020. And they can accomplish that goal rather easily. They just have to have no people and produce nothing. San Francisco has a vision. A vision they do. They do. It's just not our vision, not the same vision we have for our children. This recycling idea is everywhere. In fact, some churches, you'll be told, failure to recycle is one of the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not fail to recycle. And you'll hear more about recycling and about environmentalism from some of the pulpits in this land than you will about the sins of adultery, of fornication, and of stealing. In a study by the Mises Institute, they found that recycling, the kind of recycling that is forced upon, well, where my in-laws used to live, they lived in a place where you must separate your trash out. You had to put your cans in one bag. You had to put your bottles in another bag. You had to put your paper trash in another bag. They charged you by the bag, and it was mandatory separation. You had to rinse your cans and your bottles, too, by the way. You were responsible for that. That kind of curbside recycling costs between 35 and 55% more than any other recycling method. It uses huge amounts of capital and labor per pound of material recycled. Recycling itself uses three times more resources than just does depositing in the landfills. The price for recycling tends to soar far higher than the combined cost of manufacturing raw materials from virgin sources and dumping the rubbish into the landfills. So if we look at the costs, the economic costs, and the amount of energy used, which is part of those costs, transportation costs, material costs, which are all part of the equation and tells you how much something impacts the standard of life, recycling is a foolish thing to do. When you look at paper, recycling paper is very, very popular. You know, when you recycle paper, it must be reduced to a pulp, and then they have to de-ink it, creating a sludge, another product that has to be taken to the landfill or dealt with in some way. You do create a waste product, but the energy that it takes to make recycled paper far exceeds the energy it takes to cut down the tree, to process the tree, and to press it into paper. But all that being said, when you buy a ream of paper for your printer down at the store, that came from a tree. When they cut down that tree, they planted three trees to replace the tree they cut down. Why? Because trees that are cut down for paper exist on private property, and they're viewed as a crop. And what do you do with crops? You plant crops. You plant crops in order to get a yield. Now, you don't get it in 1 year with trees. It takes a vision. You want to have some trees there for your children. So the people who actually are in the forestry industry care more about their children than those in the recycling industry, I would say, based on their behaviors. And there are more trees today growing in the United States, in the lower 48, than there was when the Pilgrims landed. Why? Because trees are a resource, not a scarce resource, but a resource that man can control. We plant crops. Now, if I were to say there was more corn stalks here than when the Pilgrims landed, no one would be surprised. But when you say trees, no one thinks that there's more trees. But there are more trees than there was when the Pilgrims landed. Why? Because we do things with trees, which makes trees valuable. And those who have foresight in a free economic system, in a free market system, plant trees. Trees are good, so they're going to keep them around. See, the recyclers, professing to become wise, became fools. No, I'm not saying all recycling. Of course, I'm not saying all recycling is foolish. I already said that landfills are a form of recycling. Recycling iron makes a great deal of sense because the cost of coal and the cost of producing the iron exceeds the cost of recycling it. So there's an instance where recycling a product makes good economic sense. Now, take the model of the guy who takes his aluminum cans, and maybe he takes them around from the neighborhood. He goes to the little machine, and he puts them in the little machine, and the machine spits out coins when he puts the cans in. He's enriched for his labors. He brings the cans to the machine gives him cash, he's enriched. We have now had an exchange of products and services for an exchange of capital. The machine, the company that owns that machine paid out a certain amount of money in order to acquire those cans, very little labor to themselves, and it makes sense then because now they're able to take that aluminum and they're able to melt it down and produce a raw form of aluminum. They're able to sell to Coca-Cola to make cans. But they're able to do that at a profit. So the company that runs the machines made a profit. The person who brought the cans to the machine made a profit. And now Coca-Cola is able to buy the aluminum at a cost that was less than the raw materials. They made a profit. And what we had here now is in the exchange of goods and services, an actual expansion of the economy and not a contraction, which is what results in forced recycling. Look, what are we saying here? Simple. Professing to become wise, they became fools because they did not glorify God and nor were grateful. That's what Paul says in Romans. They became fools and they worshiped the created order rather than the Creator. Those who hug the trees, who worship on Earth Day, who force recycling and are in Copenhagen trying to fix the weather, don't fear God. They don't fear the Creator, but rather they worship what He created. In order to preserve a world for our children, we need to teach our children that the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. We need to teach our children to glorify the Creator and to be grateful. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is just one of the economic principles that we're going to talk about at our economic conference coming up in March here in Colorado in Castle Rock, Colorado. And it's the principle of dominion. God gave us resources and He expects us to use them. He doesn't want us to bury our talents in the ground. He wants us to use the resources and bring a return on them, end up with more resources than we started, more talents than we were given initially in order to build the kingdom of God. This principle is just but one that we're going to talk about at the Family Economic Conference coming up in March. It's a conference for the whole family, priced per family, not per individual, and we're even going to feed you there. If you haven't signed up for the conference, please sign up today. Go to kevinswanson.com, click on the Family Economic Conference. My name is Dave Buhner. I hope you'll join us again next time as we cast a vision for the next generation.